Babel doesn't elicit our sympathy for cripples, Jews, or murdered grandfathers. Instead, he registers the joy of clarity, the clarity of a toughened and presumably more truthful culture. But we do indeed have something to mourn. Alas, Babel badly underestimated the true evils of the communist revolution.
Welcome to The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. This week, we'll be reading The Story of My Dovecote by Isaac Babel. This season of The Stories Jews Tell is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Our story today is The Story of My Dovecote. Isaac Babel is one of those writers who makes it worth learning his language just to read him in the original. Fortunately, his several translators are a great help to those like me who don't have access to him in Russian. So here I'll be using the translation by Peter Constantine in the complete works of Isaac Babel, occasionally checking it against others. When Babel published this story in 1925, he dedicated it to Maxim Gorky, then Russia's most famous writer. Having encouraged the young Babel when he was first starting out, Gorky remained his champion in the Stalinist years when Babel was badly in need of political protection. This particular story ranks very high in the modern Jewish literary canon, but we should note that Gorky called Babel the great hope of Russian literature. So this is the first work we've read whose author belongs to another literature as much as he does to ours. Isaac Babel was born in 1894 in Odessa, which he describes as a town where you can live free and easy. Half the population is made up of Jews, and Jews are a people who have learned a few simple truths along the way. Jews get married so as not to be alone, love so as to live through the centuries, hoard money so that they can buy houses and give their wives Astrakhan jackets, love children, because let's face it, it is good and important to love one's children. The humorous image of this collective community reminds us of Shalom Aleichem, whom Babel read and whose work he later curated in a Russian edition. From his very first stories, Babel wrote as a Jewish native of Odessa. And though he knew and read Yiddish, French, German, English, and a little Hebrew, he always wrote in Russian, aspiring to be that great Russian writer predicted by Gorky. So here is how our story begins. As a child, I wanted a dovecote very badly. In all my life, I have never desired anything more intensely. I was 9 years old when my father promised to give me the money to buy some planks and 3 pairs of doves. The year was 1904. I was getting ready for examinations for the preparatory class of the Nikolaev Gymnasium. My family lived in Nikolaev in the province of Kherson. This province no longer exists. Our town was absorbed into the district of Odessa. In publishing this story, Babel indicated that it was the beginning of a series of autobiographical fictions that are among the best of his works. Autobiographical fiction is a hybrid term that blends two otherwise competing forms. Autobiography promises to be truthful, whereas fiction implies the imaginative manipulation of reality. What happens in our story corresponds with many details of Babel's life, even as the term story acknowledges that through selection, compression, and all the many tools of his craft, he is using his life as the scaffolding for his fiction. In the sentences I just quoted, the retrospective phrase, "I have never desired anything more intensely," fits seamlessly with the exact date and place of the story, a province that no longer exists and was absorbed into another. Readers would have known that 1904 marked the prelude of the first abortive Russian Revolution, and that a boy who was craving doves in a season of violence might find himself in the wrong place at the wrong time. Blending a personal coming-of-age story with real and historically significant events Babel distills the fused national experience of Jews and of Russia. Conditions governing Jewish life in Odessa at the beginning of the 20th century were improving, but by no means ideal. The local lycée, or secondary school, accepted only two Jewish boys a year, so that a candidate had to score perfect grades of 5 for admission. "You Must Know Everything" was the title of an earlier story that Babel had written about the pressure that was applied to him as a child to learn and study as a way of arming him for life. But though he did score perfect 5s that first year, a wealthier Jew had bribed the school officials to admit his son instead. So the next year, our narrator took the exams again, and this time the examiners simply could not refuse him. The story begins with that triumph over adversity. In preparing for his second set of exams, the boy tells us that he had learned by heart whole sections of verse by the revered Russian poet Alexander Pushkin. When he is tested, he goes into a kind of trance, the faces of the two examiners swarming before his eyes, while I, shivering, straight-backed, shouted out Pushkin's verses with all my might, as fast as I could. I went on shouting the verses for a long time, nobody interrupting my crazed rambling. Across my crimson blindness, across the freedom that had taken hold of me, I saw only Pyatnitsky's old face leaning forward with its silvery beard. He did not interrupt me, but turned to Karavayev, who was rejoicing in Pushkin and me, and whispered, "What a nation! The devil is in these Yids." The prejudice is there in those two examiners, but also admiration and earned respect. When the boy then goes out into the corridor and the other children start teasing him, the deputy commissioner Pyatnitsky appears and tells the boys to leave this boy alone. "My little friend," he says, "you can go and tell your father that you have been accepted." This is still old Russia, under the Tsars, where it almost seems that if a Jewish family tries hard enough, it can surmount the obstacles being put in its way. Of course, the family celebrates, the father deliriously, the mother much more cautiously, for, he writes, she was the only one who fully realized how luckless our family was. The paternal side of the family has had some weak and unstable men, and the father himself is too trusting and is always cheated. But on this occasion, they all let themselves go, including Great Uncle Shoyl from the mother's side of the family, whom they call Grandpa. Shoyl is a fishmonger without intellectual aspirations, whom the boy loves for his tall stories about his bravery in the 1860s Polish uprising against Russian rule, and it is Shoyl who builds the boy his dovecot. For the moment, the boy's success gives everyone cause for happiness, and his mother even allows herself a bit of wine at the celebration. So having performed heroically, the narrator gets his reward. Father gives him the money to buy the birds, and then comes one of those moments about which Babel would once say, quote, "No iron can pierce the heart with such force as a period put just at the right place." Here's the sentence. "On Sunday, October 22nd, I set off to the wild game market, but I ran into unexpected obstacles along the way." Whatever may actually have happened, Babel situates this episode in history. The story I am relating here, in other words, my entry into the first class of the lycée, took place in the autumn of 1905. Tsar Nicholas was in the process of giving the Russian people a constitution, and orators in threadbare coats were clambering onto podiums outside the buildings of the town councils and giving speeches to the people. Thus, the fulfillment of the boy's desires for a dovecot and a coveted place in school coincides with a promised constitution in the life of the nation. Those orators in threadbare coats are clamoring unto podiums to welcome the prospect of a democratic Russia. Unelected young men without money or organizational backing are charging up their fellow citizens with excitement and high hopes. But at night, shots are fired in the streets. Our author informs us that 2 days earlier, the boys from next door were flying a kite right outside the police station, and our water carrier, abandoning all his duties, strolled, pomaded, and red-faced along the street. Then we saw the sons of the baker drag a leather vaulting horse out onto the street and start to do their exercises right there in the middle of the road. Nobody tried to stop them. The constable was even egging them on to jump higher. Now, these goings-on suggest a strange kind of holiday on which the street was turned into a circus. The sight of the out-of-uniform policeman, writes the author, frightened my mother more than anything else, and it was because of him that she would not let me go out. But I crept out onto the street through backyards and ran all the way to the wild game market, which lay behind the train station. By the end of this description, the exuberant expectation of a constitution is throbbing ominously with the danger of an unpoliced city. Jewish families, formerly at the mercy of biased officials, now face the collapse of whatever protection that system had still provided. Had this story been written to engage our sympathies, our handkerchiefs should now be readied for tears lamenting the fate of this child and his world. But the adult Babel, the writer, is after something else. The market is already emptying out when the boy arrives to make his purchase. In fact, the dove seller lets him have his own two favorite birds at a bargain price. During this transaction, a passerby cheerfully informs the dove teller that, in town, the nobles of Jerusalem are being given a constitution, and in the fish market, they've just served Grandpa Bobble a helping of death. Can he have heard that right? Hiding the birds under his shirt, the boy tries to take a shortcut home, but at the end of an alley, he runs into the legless tobacco seller, Makarenko, in his wheelchair, accompanied by his wife, Katyusha. The schoolchildren like this man because he sells them cigarettes. Makarenko, I said, breathless from running, and patted the legless man on the shoulder. Have you seen Shoyl? What have you got there in that bag? Makarenko said, snatching away the sack that had warmed my heart. The cripple's fat hand turned the sack upside down, and he pulled out a cherry red dove. The bird lay in his palm, its feet sticking up. Doves, Makarenko said, and rolled up to me with squeaking wheels. Doves, he repeated, and slapped me across the face. He hit me hard with the palm of his hand, crushing the bird. Katyusha's backside loomed before my eyes, and I fell down in my new overcoat. Their seed has to be stamped out, she shouts. I cannot abide their seed and their stinking men. An author writing sentimental fiction would not have chosen for a sadist someone disabled, presumably pitiable, and liked by schoolchildren. But this man and his wife Katyusha are in the grip of the pogrom, and they are busy toting up their take from the looted Jewish homes and stores. Furious at having actually gotten so little, they take out their anger on this boy. These people, for whose sake the orators in their threadbare coats want a constitution, turn out to be the very people the boy has most to fear. The pogrom is already democratic, so to speak, in that it attacks all Jews alike, including the Efrusi family that had cheated the boy out of admission to the school. But as the madness rages around him, and Makarenko's wife continues cursing the Jewish seed, the boy tells us that he no longer heard anything. I lay on the ground, the innards of the crushed bird trickling down the side of my face. They trickled, winding and dribbling down my cheek, blinding me. The dove's tender entrails slithered over my forehead, and I closed my uncaked eye so that I would not see the world unravel before me. This world was small and ugly. A pebble lay in front of my eyes, a pebble dented like the face of an old woman with a large jaw. A piece of string lay near it, and a clump of feathers, still breathing. My world was small and ugly. I closed my eyes so I wouldn't see it, and pressed myself against the earth that lay soothing and mute beneath me. This tamped earth did not resemble anything in our lives. Somewhere far away, disaster rode across it on a large horse, but the sound of its hooves grew weaker and vanished, and silence, the bitter silence that can descend on children in times of misfortune, dissolved the boundary between my body and the unmoving earth. The earth smelled of damp depths, of tombs, of flowers. I breathed in its scent and cried, without the slightest fear. Now, Babel teaches us to read as he has just learned to see, pressing our uncaked eyes onto the words more intensely than we have ever done. The action stops momentarily. If we were to translate this into cinematographic terms, the camera would now zoom in to the perspective of the boy on the ground. Babel has learned what life had to teach, not from the school his family hoped would secure his future, and not from his birds, feeling the earth beneath him. What the earth takes and what it gives has made him a writer without the slightest fear. And what is this writer's material? Well, the passage I just quoted leads to this surprising sentence. I walked down a foreign street filled with white boxes, walking in my raiment of blood-drenched feathers, alone on sidewalks, swept clean as on a Sunday, and I cried more bitterly, more fully, and happily than I would ever cry again. The story that began with desiring something more intensely than anything in his life has brought him to crying more happily than he would ever cry again. We think this must be a mistranslation, and we check it against others, but they all say, happily. My raiment of blood-drenched feathers seems equally wrong, since how can he feel grandly attired in the bloody feathers of his slaughtered birds? Simply, the boy has undergone a rite of passage, and he is aware of his newly elevated stature. The foreign-seeming street is filled with white boxes from the emptied Jewish stores that have been wrecked, and he is alone on sidewalks, swept clean as on a Sunday, as on the day when everyone goes to church. This child is only a bit player in the performance of a Russian sacrament, a ritual pogrom against the Jews. Yet he has been assigned a leading part in the drama of the violence-induced, material and earthbound Soviet Union that is coming into being. Now, as we know, we are not yet done. When the boy reaches home, he finds his dovecote smashed to pieces and the janitor, Kuzma, laying out Shoyl's dead body. What was overheard in the marketplace prepared us for this, and since our narrator spares us nothing, he now observes the fun his neighbors had with the old man, sticking fish into his fly and into his mouth. The boy surveys the fish still wriggling in the dead man's now inert sources of power. But Kuzma brings that power back to life. He cursed their goddamn mothers, he said, smiling, and looked at the corpse lovingly. If they had been Tatars attacking him, he would have fought them off too. Now, Babel often describes Jews who have been murdered, not running away from their enemies, but facing them. Grandpa Shoyl died opposing his killers. The boy makes sure to register the evidence as scrupulously and as carefully as Kuzma tends to the grandfather's body. The janitor then takes the boy to the house of the tax inspector, where his parents, sick with worry about him, have hidden all day from the pogrom. This Jewish family comprises three generations. The tough fishmonger, who lived alongside Poles and Russians all his life, the parents who want a better bourgeois life and expect their child's help in attaining it, and the child who evolves before our eyes into a hardened writer. Babel's contemporary, the writer and critic Victor Shklovsky, said that he was ashamed to take a close look at Babel. The description of Grandpa Scheuel with the fish wriggling in his dead body is the kind of passage that Shklovsky had in mind. Delicate readers want to turn their eyes away from what Babel makes us look at and see. In leaving childhood behind, the story also leaves behind the Tsarist regime. The absorption of Nikolaev into the district of Odessa, recalled in the opening paragraph, resulted from the absorption of the old Russia into the Soviet Union, which outlawed both anti-Semitism and bourgeois Odessa. Babel felt free to tell the truth about the past because he wrote this when the Soviet government had undertaken to transform all human society, Jews and anti-Jews alike. Mendele Moichersvorim and Sholem Aleichem wrote analogous stories about a boy's sacrifice of childhood. But whereas they mourned their loss of a calf, a penknife, or a fiddle, Isaac Babel, the man telling this story, feels liberated from his childhood. Babel knows that the Jewish boy's dream of sheltering doves is no longer sustainable, and instead of mourning, he rises resurrected to become the new kind of chronicler the century needs. The boy's Jewish ordeal earns him the right to tell the truth literally from the ground up. Babel doesn't elicit our sympathy for cripples, Jews, or murdered grandfathers. Instead, he registers the joy of clarity, the clarity of a toughened and presumably more truthful culture. But we do indeed have something to mourn. Alas, Babel badly underestimated the true evils of the communist revolution, evils that were not yet fully apparent when he wrote these autobiographical stories. Never a Communist Party insider, and distrusted even while becoming a famous writer in the Soviet Union, he knew the risks he was taking, and during the Great Terror of the late 1930s, he tried to stay out of trouble, but it was too late for the sensitive boy who remained very present in the adult author. The revolution stamped out Jewish sensibility far more brutally than the crippled Makarenko had smashed his doves. When the regime arrested, tortured, and executed Babel on the 27th of January 1940, there was no one to do for him what Kuzma the janitor did for Grandpa Scheuel. We bring that knowledge to this remarkable story, which lives happily just as he wrote it. And that is it for today. Next week, we will read a Hebrew-Israeli story by Chaim Hazaz. And in the meantime, I wish you happy reading.